Welcome back, dudes. Another episode of the Elvis Reviews podcast. We're back. It is March 2024.
Yes, it is.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello, everyone. You would have seen the title. You know what we're going to talk about. It's the big second album. Is sophomore, is that the word?
Yeah.
Is that what they use for this?
His sophomore
album. Seems like a high school thing, but I don't know.
It is, but yeah, I definitely have heard albums, you know, the second album referred to as the
big
sophomore.
Second album.
Yeah.
So, we're going to talk about Elvis Presley, in case you just stumbled upon this somehow and you didn't know what it was.
Right.
Okay, what do you got to say?
Well, let's see. So last time we checked in with Elvis, he was playing Las Vegas in April, I think. And then after that, he went on TV. He's done a whole bunch of stuff. Right before this whole album gets recorded in like a weekend, like September 1st.
Oh, yeah, I saw that. It was like 3 days, the whole thing.
Yeah, and prior to that, he's already doing Love Me Tender. And right after that, he goes directly back into Love Me Tender. I mean, shooting and recording the music for it.
Oh, the movie. Yeah.
To me, this album always gets kind of lost between the cracks somehow. I mean, it came out, it was number one. It sold 200,000 more copies than the previous one.
Oh, than the first album? Wow.
Yeah, so it was major. It was a massive album, but I think because the movies come right up, you know, right after this, I feel like I kind of forget about this album all the time. And there are no singles really from it. Yeah, there really are no singles from it really at all.
Because, I saw that. It was 4 weeks at number one on the Billboard Top Pop Albums chart that year.
Yes.
Making Elvis the first recording artist to have both albums go straight to number one in the same year. Well, there you go.
Yeah, I think they were two of the most popular. It was like three albums that were like the biggest albums of 1956. Two of them were Elvis. And I kind of think the other one might have been like Calypso or something.
Oh.
It doesn't matter. But yeah, it was a huge album. It came out on October 19th, 1956, which was the same day that all the charges against Elvis were dropped from a gas station incident that had happened a few days before that, where he stopped at a gas station, a crowd gathered, so he was signing some autographs, and then like the owner of the gas station was like trying to tell him to move along and slapped him in the back of the head, and so Elvis punched him and got taken to court. On the same date that this album was released, all the charges were dropped. So it was a good day for Elvis.
I haven't heard that story.
Oh, really? Yeah. There's footage of him in court and everything.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, he punched some guy in the eye because he slapped him in the back of the head.
So we should. Self-defense.
Yeah, exactly. That's why the charges are dropped.
But it makes me wonder, was the gas station guy just annoyed that Elvis was like clogging up his area? Or was he thinking like, if I provoke Elvis and he slaps me, I can sue him for $1 million?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they thought like that back then.
Yeah, back then it wasn't. Now, that's the first thing people think.
Yeah, no, he probably just thought, like at the time, Elvis was, again, the adults were very anti-Elvis at the time. And so
who's this young hooligan clogging up my service station? Yeah.
Yeah, and so also the same day that the album came out, the EP came out, which just had two songs on each side. And this always confuses me, but Love Me was one of the songs. And on the strength of the EP, it still got to like number six on the singles charts. I just don't understand how that works. I mean, if it's not a single, why do you even, you know what I mean? It would be like, oh, this album was so good, it made number one on the singles chart. It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, it's...
Well, I guess it's airplay, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know
the
how.
Individual track, yeah.
At some point, they obviously changed the way that things were categorized because you have a single and there's a B-side, and the B-side's usually just nothing.
Right.
It's like an album track, or it could be a...
instrumental or something.
Could be an instrumental, could be a song that wasn't on the album, and then you're like, then that's a great incentive to buy the single because you want to get that track.
Right.
But then they started with like double A sides, and then you're like, well, how do they measure the sales base? Well, was it that song or was it the other A side on there? And you see, like, what was the song that made it number one? Was it both? Was it neither? It's just, it's just weird how they calculated things. And at some point they changed it, obviously, because double A sides haven't been, I haven't seen a double A side for a long time.
Well, yeah, I haven't seen anything with sides for a while.
Yeah. They're still printing vinyl, but is it only albums? I don't know if they're doing singles.
Did you see that they just reopened Tower Records in like Tokyo, I think?
Oh, wow.
Yeah, a couple of days ago, it was a news story that there's like a big Tower Records reopening full of vinyl in Japan.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah, it's coming back.
Oh, if I can get to Japan, I'll be going there.
Yeah, I'm so mad I got rid of most of my vinyl. Anyway.
Mm.
So yeah, the EP came out the same day as the album, and basically Love Me wasn't a single, but still charted, still got to number six.
Even that decision also makes you think, what was the business thinking behind releasing the album and the EP on the same day?
Yeah.
I mean,
there were a lot of weird...
were they thinking, well, maybe some people can't afford the album, which maybe costs like $6. The EP is only $2, so we'll still get some money from these people, even if they can't go for the album. I mean, just the logic of releasing... I mean, they're the same tracks, right? It's the same four tracks, which are on the album. So it just makes you think, are they just making it as available as possible? It's weird.
It seems. Well, like I said, this album was recorded on like September 1st, 2nd, and 3rd. On August 31st, the day before the recording session, in an industry first, RCA releases 7 singles simultaneously, 6 of them from Elvis's first album. And the 7th one is Shake, Rattle, and Roll, Lottie, Miss Quality, which... isn't on either.
Again, looking at that, it seems like such a dumb decision. Just release one every month. Why would you do 7 in a day? It's like...
yeah, it said the combined...
Again, people have limited money.
Yeah.
They can't afford to go and buy like 7 records in a day.
It was the entire album.
But you spread it out. You spread it out one every few weeks, once a month. That's affordable for most people.
I guess they think somebody doesn't want to buy the album, and so now they have... every single song that was on the album on a single. So if they just want 2 songs off the album, I mean, yeah, it's weird. It's very weird thinking. But yeah, that's what they did.
If anyone knows some of the reasons for these decisions, please let us know. ElvisReviewsPodcast@gmail.com, because I could probably go Google things and spend half a day trying to find that information. But if anybody knows, just let us know, because it hurts my head sometimes. And just like, why? Why did they do that?
Yeah. Well, the other thing that's weird is, I mean, when you think about it, the way it was done, if it was a really strong song, then that became a single and wasn't going to go on the album.
Yep.
So pretty much by design, albums are full of tracks not good enough to be singles. So they're lesser than...
yeah, that was the thinking back then. Like, if you had a great song, it was a single.
Yeah.
And it usually wasn't on the album.
Which is weird.
It didn't take that long before they started thinking.
Yeah.
Like James Brown did this. He'd put out single, and then eventually there'd be 10 or 12 tracks, and then someone had the genius idea, let's just put all these on one album, because that's going to be, you know, all the singles sold well. So
and that's
all of them
be,
combined on the album has got to sell well.
Right. That's going to be Elvis Gold Records Volume 1 for us.
Mm. I mean, today you would look at that and go, well, that's a compilation.
Right.
It's like a best of or a compilation. But at the time, it was, I mean, if it was a single and it had never been on an album, when the album comes out, I mean, it's technically a compilation of singles.
Well,
but those singles have never been released on an album before, so it's not really. It's weird.
Well, the very same year, Little Richard's first album comes out, and it has 3 of the same tracks that are on this album. It has Rip It Up, Long Tall Sally, and Ready Teddy. And those were singles first for Little Richard, and then they were compiled on his first album. Whereas Elvis, Elvis is doing things different, I guess, because he's under contract now, and they've got him in the recording studio. So it's not like Little Richard at this point is, let's see if we release a single if it's a hit. And it's kind of a more tentative thing, the way it was like at Sun, you know? Because, yeah, they weren't even thinking about, let's record an album. Really, until like,
let's record a song and get it out. And yeah, that's the way you did it.
In fact, technically, this is really Elvis's first full-fledged album, you know, because that first album had a bunch of tracks from Sun, and then, you know, he did record a few for that first album.
Yeah, it was sort of a hodgepodge.
It's funny, I never thought about this before, but it's a little bit like his very last album, Moody Blue. It was a hodgepodge, but because it had live stuff. But his first and last album really are sort of a little bit mixed, which is interesting. Mm. It's not just one session.
Anyway. So, as most of you know by now, if you've been listening, I haven't heard every studio track, every album, but I have heard a lot of live stuff. And there's a bunch of songs on here which I have literally never heard before. Will I like them or not? Oh, you'll have to hang around and you'll find out. But yeah, it's funny going back to albums because I haven't heard all the albums.
Yeah.
Like I remember at some point I got like that 70s box set and I listened through all of that. But the actual original albums, I just never thought, oh, I want to go and listen to those.
Yeah.
And now we're doing it, so it's great.
Yeah, I haven't gone back and listened to this. Especially once you get that 50s box set. that's just got everything on it. Yeah, it's rare that you revisit the original album.
One last thing I'll say before we start is there is a big negative to this album, and we'll get to it, but it's just the amount of reverb on some of these tracks, on most of the tracks, if not all.
Oh, really? There's only...
Like, at times, my ears were just, they had enough. And I just had to turn it off. It just became unlistenable. Like, my ears were just tired. I don't know. I don't know what it was.
Yeah.
It's just so off-putting to me. Like, And it took me a long time to do the notes for this because I could only get through a couple of songs and then I was just so annoyed at the reverb and I just had to have a few days off and come back to it.
Yeah, I only had that issue really with one track. It does make me wonder what you're going to say when we get to Heartbreak Hotel, which, of course, isn't on this album, but it's got a lot of reverb. So I'm curious to how.
Yeah, some tracks are worse than others, but just the amount of reverb is just like, oh my God. Anyway, starting off on a great negative like that. Okay, side A. It's a track. It's track one. It's Rip It Up, written by Robert Blackwell and John Mariscalco.
Yes.
1 minute 50. Start off nice and short. Here we go.
Yes, sure. And this, of course, was written, I guess, with Little Richard particularly in mind, or I think he knows Robert Blackwell and that other guy. So this was, yeah, a Little Richard song. I have that it reached number 25 on the Billboard Hot 100. It probably got higher than that on the R&B chart, but for some reason I don't have that info. But yeah, that's all I've got for like background. I think it's a good, it's definitely a good way to kick off the album.
If you were falling asleep, this is going to wake you up.
Mm-hmm.
For sure. But straight away, the reverb. first track.
Yeah, I don't even notice it in the first track. I mean, I know it's there, but yeah, I don't even really notice it too much on this one. I guess they were doing it at Sun Records and it was just kind of the thing back then.
Yeah, like I've said before, it's just the most annoying thing. And it was just this trend at the time.
Yeah.
And it's not like Elvis needed it. His voice was better than most people putting out stuff at the time. So I just find it just such an unnecessary choice.
Yeah.
To use it. But that was the trend. So they used it. But a lot of times it was used, people weren't that great. Some
right.
people weren't that great singers. It's like, just chuck up the reverb and that'll just cover up any problems I've got. And it's
it
like,
does.
Elvis didn't need that.
No.
Didn't need it.
I'm trying to think of other songs with like a lot of reverb. Bebopalula by Gene Vincent is the first thing that comes to mind. And I can't even imagine that without the reverb, though.
True.
I don't disagree with you because there are tracks. There's really one, especially on this album, that I think the reverb practically ruins. But yeah, other ones, I don't know. It was just, I guess it was like keyboards in the 80s. It was just, put it on everything.
Yeah.
This is what the kids like. This is cool.
It's the cool trend.
After this album, I don't think you'll find it very much anymore.
I hope so. I hope
I really
it wasn't
don't.
A long-lasting trend. It was just for a couple of years and then it was gone. Or
yeah.
at least cut way down.
I mean,
it's very rare that you'll hear any song
right.
which doesn't have a tiny bit of reverb on the vocal. Like, to have totally flat vocals is very rare.
Right.
There's always some sort of effect on a vocal, but it's like they just invented reverb and it's like, put it up to 100. This is this great new thing. And then slowly they pulled it back. And now, yeah, most songs, there's a little bit, but it's not, you know, it's like 10. It's 10% instead of 98.
Yeah. There's like two songs I can think of. And one of them is the Bruce Springsteen song called State Trooper. But he's flat out mimicking Elvis's version of Blue Moon, which has got tons of echo.
Yeah.
And then, of course, I was thinking about Prince, the song Solo, which is like massive. Well, there's no music. It's just reverb, really.
Oh, no. There's David Huang on the harp. Don't forget him.
Yeah, there's little.
Why do I remember such useless information like that? Seriously, I probably read that 25 years ago and it's still just sitting in my head.
Yeah. But lots of reverb. Just thinking of reverb.
Yeah.
But I will say that I mean, I like Elvis's version of Rip It Up. I like it better than Little Richard's, but not by a lot. I really like Little Richard's version too. But I feel like I mentioned this before, so I might as well mention it again. Little Richard had lots of horns on his early rock and roll stuff, which was recorded in New Orleans, by the way, which I didn't even know until researching for this. But most of Little Richard's first album and singles were recorded down here. And yeah, I just think there's a difference between Elvis when he strips away the horns and it's just this lean kind of rock sound compared to the big, much more swing oriented rock and roll that was coming out of south of Elvis. So, but that's all. I had to at least mention Little Richard's version.
Yeah.
So,
okay. So let's go track number two, a song that I know, Love Me, Jerry Lieber, Mike Stoller.
Yeah.
Now they'd just written Hound Dog. Yeah. Oh, which was a big hit.
Oh, yeah. I'm trying to think if they had written any. No, I guess Hound Dog was the first one, and I guess this must be the second one. Oh, I hope I'm not getting that wrong.
And then there was a whole bunch. Yeah. Jailhouse Rock and, you know, all the others.
King Creole and, yeah, yeah.
So many. But this, I mean, this is just a classic. This is one that I know so well from all the live shows. Mm-hmm. It's just, they know how to write songs, those two.
Yeah.
The duo. The original album version, it sounds a fair bit slower than the way he did it live, but it's probably not that much difference. He usually did speed stuff up a bit for, right. on the stage. This one just seems to drag just a little bit. It's just a bit slow. They could have just made it, it's 2 minutes 41.
Yeah.
I mean, just cut like 10 seconds off that. Just speed it up a bit. It just seems, it's just a little bit too slow for me. I don't want it as fast as the live ones because I know right. there's a reason why he played it faster live.
Yeah.
And as you know, again, reverb, but what can you do?
Right.
But that's all I got. It's a great song. I've heard it a million times live. I always like it.
Me too. It is kind of hard to, I kept trying to figure out how to, because I don't even know what to say about it exactly. The song is so perfect for Elvis, and he's so good at whatever he's doing. I mean, he's singing, but he's doing, I don't even know what to call it, because I don't know that I've heard very many other male singers do this kind of like sexual, maybe that's not even the right word. But I mean, he just found a way to really key into the part of this song that he knew girls were going to scream about and were just going to go nuts for.
Okay. That's what you mean. Because I was just thinking, I wouldn't call this a sexual song, yeah, but I know what you're saying.
Yeah, that might have been the wrong choice
just
of word.
The way that he presents it, the way that he,
yeah,
I don't know, translates.
It's not something a lot of male, I hate to bring Prince up again, but other than Prince, there's not a lot of male singers who would just lean this far into, is it sexuality or is it just like the sort of come on? I don't know what the hell it is, but it's such a perfectly.
Well, that was, I mean, from the start, that was Elvis's.
Yeah, it was.
Sort of thing. It's like, but yeah, it is hard to describe what exactly he did. The charisma was a big part of it.
Yeah.
Just him standing there, just the way that he presented himself, even just standing there.
Yeah.
And he was pretty good looking, let's say that. So yeah, the girls just lost their minds. And then as soon as he started shaking his leg or shaking something else, they just lost their minds because no one else was doing that.
Right. But him just like leaning in and like asking, basically pleading for a girl to love me. It was just, I mean, it had to drive him nuts and he had to just know this was. It just was so perfect for him.
And he kept it. I mean, he did this song for a long time.
He did. It is a great song. Lieber and Stoller have said many times that it was written as a parody of a country song.
Oh, but, yeah.
And I never did go back and listen to that Willie and Ruth version from 1954. Oh, yeah. I should have. It's probably on YouTube, but I didn't check it out. I assume it's totally different. Yeah, Elvis, he just had this innate way of focusing in on something that would work perfectly for him and... This is just one of those songs.
Again, it shows how good he was at taking a song and making it his own. If this was originally a parody, I mean, listening to this, I didn't know that, and I never would have guessed it because it sounds 1,000% sincere.
Yeah.
Just the way that he sings it, I don't pay that much attention to the lyrics, but it sounds sincere.
Mm-hmm.
So to know that it was originally a parody, yeah, wow. Because I never got that from it, but he just totally transformed it.
He really did. And yeah,
that's what he does.
He does it time and again. But yeah, this is definitely a classic, and you could see why he sang it all the way up until 77.
So let's go to track 3. This really sounds like a soundtrack song to me.
Oh, okay.
Track 3, When My Blue Moon Turns to Gold Again. Gene Sullivan, Wiley Walker. That's a good name. 218.
Yes.
Now, there's hints of that jumpy vocal style, which we talked about on the first album. It's not that bad here, but just that style that so many people made fun of and probably some still do.
Yeah.
But it fits this song. It's not over the top like it was on the first album on a couple of songs.
Right.
But I like this song. It's just a nice little song. It's got a nice little guitar solo. It's a happy song.
It is.
Well, it sounds like one. The lyrics could be awful because I don't pay attention. But it sounds like a happy song.
Yeah.
But that's all I got.
Yeah, I can't remember now if he did a full version of this in 1968 at the special or not. I remember him starting to do it.
And then
he said, I'm supposed to do something before I do that. And then I don't know if he ever gets back to it. But he started to go into it in 68, which was really cool. I like this because I kind of think of this as like the third of the trilogy of Blue Moon songs. Because he had Blue Moon.
Oh, yeah.
Blue Moon of Kentucky and then Blue Moon at Sun Records. And in fact, his band was called the Blue Moon Boys for a while.
He really liked the phrase Blue Moon, apparently.
Apparently. So yeah, it's nice to have like this kind of last, this is the last Blue Moon song, I think. There's a song called Blue River in the 60s. But yeah, I think this is the last of the Blue Moons. Yeah, I like it. It's, you know, it's from 1941. Also, I didn't check out the original version. I'm sure he transformed it. Unfortunately, I have this problem with a lot of the album. It's hard to know what to say. It's a good song. It's simple.
For this album, I didn't go back to any of the originals. And I'm not sure if it was just like when I was writing notes, the reverb was really annoying me. And right. I didn't want to hear anymore. So I didn't even go that far.
The only originals I checked out were the Little Richard ones, because I figured I really should check those. I did end up checking out the Otis Blackwell demo for Paralyzed, just to see how much Elvis changed it. He changed it. These early albums, it is really hard to do track by track. It's almost easier to talk about the impact of the album as a whole. Because the songs are just like, it's a great song, but it's very basic. There's like three or four instruments, and what are you going to say? But yeah, I like it.
Okay, then.
That's it.
Then let's go to track number four. It's Long Tall Sally, written by Robert Blackwell, Enotris Johnson, and Richard Pennyman.
Little Richard.
So Robert Blackwell also wrote the other Little Richard track, didn't he?
Yeah.
Which was Rip It Up.
Right.
Yeah, I don't have a love for this. It's a great version of the Little Richard classic song.
Yeah, I was just going to mention, you might know this already, but that last name, Richard Pennyman, that is Little Richard.
Ah, it's Richard. Oh, of course it is.
Yes, that is him.
There you go. But yeah, it's a good little guitar solo. What do you say about a song like this? It's rock and roll. It's
exactly.
It's a great song.
Absolute classic rock and roll. According to my notes, Little Richard had a number one on the rhythm and blues, and a number six on the pop singles. So this was a big hit before Elvis recorded it. Again, when Elvis did it, it was an album track. I don't want to bring it up again, but yeah, when people talk about Elvis stole music, a lot of times when he covered these songs, they weren't even singles. They were just album tracks that he was covering, and it usually helped the original artist. Again, I know.
Well, yeah, I mean, if he was really trying to steal them, you'd take it and you'd put it out as a single and make loads of money.
Yeah, Long Tall Sally.
It just went on the album because he liked the song.
Right.
Just by having it on the album, the original writers are getting paid. Mm-hmm. Again, assuming everything was done correctly.
Right.
That may not always be the case back in those days, but you can hope that it was.
Right. Well, I know I've said negative things about Pat Boone often. But I had just seen there was a short little interview with him recently, and he was saying a lot of the same things I was saying about the difference between, well, he was saying that Fats Domino told him, Pat Boone, that he made more money when Pat Boone recorded Ain't That a Shame than Fats made on his own recording of Ain't That a Shame. And so, yeah, that happened frequently. I mean, there's a good chance Little Richard made more money on this than he made on... Of course, the Beatles also recorded Long Tall Sally.
Yes, so I was just thinking that.
Great version. I listened to two different versions of the Beatles doing it.
Paul McCartney's voice back in those first, like, 5 years was just insane.
Yeah.
Like, he could just scream.
Yeah.
And just listen to... Is it Oh Darlin'? If you want to hear Paul McCartney's voice, just blow your mind. That song, that's the song I think of every time.
Right. Well, that's the one
because
he said.
He just screams.
Well, he said it in the studio. He had to lie flat on his back to sing that song.
Oh, yeah.
At least that's what he says.
That's the thing that we know Prince did as well. So there must be something in that.
Yeah.
I think it was Do Me Baby, like one of them early songs.
Mm-hmm.
Whoever the engineers were, they were like, I remember he told everyone to get out and he'd just lie on the floor and record his vocal.
Long
Tall Sally.
Great vocal. Love Elvis's vocal. He's right on it. In fact, compared to the opening, I feel like the opening, Rip It Up, I mean, is a little bit tame compared to Long Tall Sally.
Yeah, to this one.
Yeah, because he really is on it on this vocal. And the same thing when we covered Las Vegas, he did this song there. It was one of the best. I thought it was maybe the best track he did at that Vegas gig that we just covered. But yeah, like you said, it's Long Tall Sally. It's classic, absolute classic rock and roll.
One thing you just said about Fats Domino put out a song.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he got a certain amount of money for that. Pat Boone covers it, puts it out, and makes way more.
Right.
I mean, you can look at that in a race way if you want to do that. But to me, in my head, it's just numbers.
Right.
I mean, if the black population of America was like 15%, that's the 15% that's going to buy the Fats Domino records, maybe some white people. But then Pat Boone puts out exactly the same song. Then you've got 85%
right.
white people or just everyone else and that's, buying it. So, I mean, it's just numbers, right. really.
But it did also increase. I mean, it wasn't just the publishing rights, I suppose, that Fats Domino got, but it also, whenever a white artist like that would put something out, it would cause certain fans to go back and find that original, buy the original.
So yeah, he's like getting paid twice.
Like that. Right. So like the Beatles especially, I mean, I think they probably would have heard, they might have heard the Pat Boone version first and then sought out the Fats Domino one. I mean, I really think it drew attention to the original artist, aside from just them getting paid royalties on a bigger selling record. So,
I mean, Prince did that. Eventually, I would have found out about certain people, but it was Prince that made me go and listen to Sly Stone and James Brown and George Clinton, because I didn't know all that stuff when I was young.
Yeah.
And then he'd like cover a song here or there or mention them or do something with them. And I'm like, oh, who's this guy? And then you'd go and listen to it.
Yeah.
So, you know, especially in like Larry Graham, Graham Central Station, you know, Prince really wanted to say, hey, look at these guys.
Yeah.
And bring attention to them. It wasn't about him at all.
No.
Which, as much as people like to talk about Prince and his giant ego, which he did have.
Right.
There was still a big space for, you know.
Oh, he was constantly trying to shine a spotlight on other artists.
Yeah, that's what I was trying to say.
Yeah, too much, really.
At some times, yeah.
Yeah, it's weird. Yeah, I agree.
Anyway, Long Tall Sally, it's great.
It is.
It's got all the things that Uncle John needs.
Yeah.
Is that the lyric? I think so.
There is a line, he claims he's got, I remember reading the lyrics being, he claims he's got the blues, but he has a lot of fun. But Elvis, I think he sings, he claims he's got the music, but he has a lot of fun. And I've thought that even in live versions, and I've never really, I'm going to have to look that up because I'm really not sure. But
you think he might have changed the word?
It sounds like he says he claims he's got the music, but he has a lot of fun, instead of he claims he's got the blues, but he has a lot of fun, which is weird. But yeah, and then there's Bald. I don't know for sure if Bald Head Sally. is a line in the original either. Long Tall Sally. But yeah, I don't know if Bald Head Sally is Elvis's own or what.
Just listening back to random live stuff that we've heard, he always seems to have a joke about baldness, doesn't he? that seemed to be a common, you know, a vein to go to for a joke.
Without any
sitting there without any hair. And,
yeah.
Yeah. I can think of a bunch, a handful, where it's always that's the joke. It's like someone being bald, that's apparently hilarious back in those days.
Yeah. Well, it's not very funny to me anyway, because I'm getting real close. So.
Yeah, it's receding. It's getting back there.
Yeah. Makes me angry.
Maybe some of our listeners can relate. I don't know.
Yeah.
Okay, next track. That's... Track five, First in Line. Aaron Schroeder and Ben Wiseman.
Yeah, co-writers also of Can't Help Falling in Love later, I think.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And a lot of Elvis 60s ballads these guys were on.
Okay, I think this may be the worst culprit so far.
It is.
For too much reverb that they just loved so much back then. Seriously, it sounds like he's three rooms away. Yeah. The song itself is okay. It's nothing amazing to me.
Mm-hmm.
But just that reverb, and I hate to keep saying it, but it's just on this track especially, it's just way too much.
I absolutely
And again,
agree.
He didn't need it. It's so unneeded. Yeah, it's a ballad. Have reverb. But this is just 180%. It's crazy.
But I wonder if it was... Like right now, if they remastered it and went back to the original tapes, could they remove the reverb? Or because it was the 50s, was he literally singing in a stairwell? Or
possibly.
Like now.
No, do you know what? I think now, with all the great, amazing AI stuff that they have, I'm sure you could like de-reverb some of these really early recordings.
Well, I would really.
And not totally take it away, but like 80%, pull it back a lot. And I would find these first couple albums so much better.
Yeah.
And I know people who've been listening to these albums forever, for decades and decades, it's part of the recording, that's the song. That's fine. You can still listen to that version, the original. But I would like it, I think. I would enjoy these songs a lot more without that trend of the time
Right.
There's always room for another version. Mm-hmm. I wonder if someone's already done it. It could even be on YouTube already. I just haven't looked.
Same here.
Someone's just cut the reverb somehow.
For all I know, they've done a remaster of the album and somehow done it.
That's possible.
I haven't even listened. I hope so, because to me, this is really the only track, maybe Any Place in Paradise is Paradise, but especially this track is the one where I completely agree with you that the reverb is so bad that I can't even understand what he's saying sometimes.
Drenched.
Yeah.
He's drowning in reverb.
In this track, yeah, he's like in the back of a cave or something.
Yeah. I mean, some people probably love it. I mean, that's, again, if you've been listening to this song for like almost 70, is it 70 years now?
Oh my God. Yeah, probably so.
Close to 70. It's like over 65 years.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sure they love the song and that's how it is. And, you know, they want to murder anybody who even thinks about changing it.
Right.
That's fine. You listen to that original. But if someone wants to make a less reverb version, I'll be quite happy with that.
Yeah, I'm 100% with you on this one. I like the song. Again, I don't think it's anything amazing. It's a nice sentiment. It's a love song, basically just complimenting the guy's girlfriend is what the lyrics are. But yeah, I like it. I don't skip it. The reverb doesn't bother me as much as you.
Oh, man. It makes me angry. Physically
I am
angry.
Used to it. I am used to it, but I would like to hear Elvis's voice without all that on this track. But yeah, that's about all I can say.
Yeah. Well, it's 3:21. I think that could be the longest song so far.
It also drags. Yeah, it is. I do think it drags maybe a little.
Cut a verse.
Maybe, yeah.
Just cut one verse and chorus out, make it about two and a half minutes.
Yeah, I would pick it up a little. Yeah, this one may be a little slow. But.
Okay, so track 6, the last track on side 8. It's Paralyzed, Otis Blackwell and Elvis Presley, a rare songwriting credit for Elvis.
Yeah, well.
And we don't know the details whether that actually happened or not, but
These sessions took place sort of in the middle of the Love Me Tender sessions that happened on either side of it. And I know Colonel Parker had a deal on the Love Me Tender sessions where Elvis was getting songwriting credit on like all of those tracks. But I don't know why. I don't know how Parker arranged it. And I imagine this is probably something similar. I don't know that Elvis. Well, I just listened to the demo of this song. And if Elvis added anything lyrically or musically, I don't know. I don't know what it would have been.
Wasn't that noticeable?
Not at all. I mean, he made it his own, but I wouldn't give him a songwriting credit. That had to be something Parker.
Yeah. I mean, as much as everybody likes to say, oh, Parker was a bastard. He was a horrible person. He ruined Elvis. In many cases, he knew what he was doing when it came to the business and the money.
Oh, yeah.
Getting Elvis songwriting credits on songs that he probably didn't have any contribution to. Genius move.
Yeah.
You know, the majority of Elvis's money, apart from concerts later on, probably would have been from these credits.
Some of them, yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Even though there wasn't a lot, but there was enough.
Yeah, well, I said Love Me Tender especially is one that I remember him having songwriting credit like throughout.
And then don't forget every cover that came after it. Everyone who's ever covered Love Me Tender.
Right. And that was a
Elvis is getting his 50 cents. He's getting something.
That's true.
Business-wise, in most of the cases, this guy knew what he was doing.
Oh, yeah. He was driven basically by greed and therefore knew. Yeah,
he followed the money. Just follow where's the money. Let's go over there.
He chased every dollar. But yeah, Paralyzed.
Anyway, the song. I've never heard the song before.
Oh, well, cool. What'd you think?
And yeah, I don't mind it. I don't love the reverb, but I like the song.
Yeah.
It's a good song.
I agree. I think it should have been a single.
Otis Blackwell. Mm-hmm.
They did release this as a single in the 80s. I don't remember if it did particularly well. I don't think it really did, but they did put it out as a single in the 80s. They put out an album of like 50 songs. To me, of course, the thing that really jumps out about this song is that the lyrics, that because of the way times have changed, the lyrics don't read exactly the same way. Because it's rare that you would think of it, that'd be a song where the singer says, I'm gay every morning and at night I'm still the same. It just doesn't come out the same these days.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's two repetitions of Elvis doing the I'm gay every morning, at night I'm still the same, which is funny. But other than that, I think it's a great song. And that might have been the problem with releasing it in the 80s, is like that lyric does not work anymore. It's a fun song, but that lyric does not really work today. So I think it might be, as far as being a more original, because the Little Richard songs were already big hits, I do think Paralyzed would have been a good choice as a single. Maybe Paralyzed with Love Me on the Back.
At the time, yeah.
Yeah, at the time.
Or even a B-side, it would have been fine.
Yeah, it's a really good song. And apparently these sessions were, for the most part, all the demos that the guy, the RCA guy, brought in, the demos that came from Colonel Parker's publishing companies, Elvis had basically turned down almost all of them. And so they were kind of scrambling for, like, that's why he ends up doing, like, Old Shep, which we haven't gotten to yet, but that's why he ends up doing When My Blue Moon Turns to Gold Again. They end up just going by his memory because he rejected most of the demos at the time.
Uh-huh.
This was one of the few he didn't reject.
Yep. Okay, so that's Paralyzed. That's a good song.
Yeah.
It's a song that I would listen to again. Reverb's not that out of control. I can listen to this one again because it's a good song. It's a good enough song.
I actually have a note that says this is an amount of reverb I like for Paralyzed. Yeah, I think it works in that song.
Yeah, it works. Just. So that is the end of side A. Let's go side B. It's track one. It's So Glad You're Mine by Arthur Crudup.
We know that name.
Now, did Arthur Crudup play guitar boogie? I've got that in my head, but I could be wrong.
I mean, Arthur Crudup is the guy who did That's All Right Mama.
That's true. That was 1946. Wow.
Yeah.
My Baby Left Me and this one. But again, this is a good song. Great guitar solo. And again, the reverb's acceptable. It's not crazy. For some reason, they're like, no, this one doesn't need it. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either. I don't know where they decided some of them it needed to be turned up to 11. And yeah.
Yeah. Knows. But yeah, 2 minutes 18. It's a good length song, actually. You don't get sick of it. But yeah, that's all I got.
What's interesting is they don't really know who's playing piano on this session.
I did read that about, yeah, there was a few songs, there was this and I think Old Shep, and they're like, they think Elvis might have been playing piano, or it might have been some other guy, but his name wasn't recorded on the papers or something.
Right. I think they said it could have been one of the Jordanaires. Gordon Jenkins, I think, also plays piano. But we're pretty sure it was Elvis on the next track, Old Shep. But yeah, I don't know if that's him on this one. But if it is, I'm kind of impressed. It's, you know, it's pretty decent. There's a noise in the song that I've heard ever since I first heard the song. And it happens at 1:08. And it's during the very first instrumental break. And there's like a weird squeak. I can't tell if it's a person making that noise. But it's like a squawking noise. It happens at like right around 1:08. It actually reminds me of...
It could be like the piano pedal or something needs some oil.
It's literally like... I mean, it's... It's really...
I'll have to check that out.
Kind of reminds me, there's a one of the songs by The Police where Sting does a noise that's really similar.
I thought you were going to say Morris Day doing the bird or squawk. Something.
Yeah, that's what I sounded more like. No, the noise actually sounds a little more like Sting doing something. But yeah, I like it. I think this album has a lot of variety, all things considered.
I was going to say that. The range of stuff.
Yeah.
And you can be sure that was, at that point, it seemed they were putting some thought into the albums and what songs were on there.
Mm-hmm.
It seemed like, you know, let's put a good range of songs, you know, that way you'll get the most appeal to people instead of just having like all rock and roll or all ballads or whatever.
Yeah. But I also think it definitely speaks to Elvis, and the same thing that we found when we listened to his 70s stuff is that he has broad taste and doesn't separate music into categories the way most people do. If it's a song he likes, if it's a rumba, he'll do it, which we're going to get to the last track. Or if it's, you know, if it's a song about a dead dog, we're going to put that on here. I love that about him, though, is he just across all genres, if it appeals to him, he's going to do it. And yeah, like this song, I don't know if this is So Glad You're Mine a rock song. I mean, not really. I don't know what to call it. It's an odd,
if it's classified as rock, it's a very like soft rock.
Yeah, I don't know what I would even classify.
It's not a ballad
song,
but it's sort of got a bit of that sound, but it's sort of somewhere in the middle.
Wasn't there something like called dance hall music? Was that a genre? Like,
oh, in the god, I don't know,
40s. I don't know, but it has a like almost like a vaudeville vibe to it. I mean, I like it. That sounds
what it is.
Yeah. But anyway, So Glad You're Mine. I don't know if that's Elvis on piano or not, but I hope so.
Well, that just reminds me, it's a year or two ago now, but there was this controversy, not in the general world, but Brian Wilson from the Beach Boys, he put out, which is probably going to be his final album because he's quite old and he's not doing very well. It's just him playing piano of like his famous songs, like Beach Boys songs and solo songs.
Yeah.
And I don't think there's any singing. It's just instrumental. But a lot of people, hardcore Brian Wilson fans have come out and said, that's not him playing, because they've listened to, you know, every Beach Boys album, every solo thing, every outtake that exists, And they're like, that's not his playing. That's not his style.
Oh, interesting.
So there's an instrumental album out there by Brian Wilson called At My Piano. And there's a fair few people saying it's probably not him, or definitely not him in some cases, they're saying.
Yeah.
So that was just interesting. I mean,
it is interesting.
Okay, so let's get on to track two, Old Shep, written by Red Foley.
Yeah.
Now, 4:10, longest track on the album. And that's probably because it's very slow.
It is, yeah.
You could imagine if this was like double the speed it was and it was like a 2-minute track. It wouldn't have quite the same sort of impact, maybe.
You can't. You can't kill a dog in 2 minutes. You gotta take four at least.
You go first on this one because I have a feeling you might like this one.
No, I don't.
Oh, okay.
It's a song that I would feel bad putting down.
Almost did to the dog.
Right, right. For what it is, it's great. I feel like it's meant for a younger person, maybe. The first time I heard it, this was on a compilation that came out after Elvis died called Elvis Sings for Children, and then in parentheses, and grown-ups too. And this was one of the songs on there, and I feel like that's kind of where this goes. Mm. Elvis, he did this because in, I think it was fourth grade, he won a contest singing this song at school. Maybe it was sixth grade.
The thing that I read that said it was one of the first songs he performed in public back in 1945 when he was 10 years old.
Right. So this could very well be because they're just grasping for material because the demos were unacceptable as far as Elvis was concerned. So he's just scraping the, you know,
what
his
about
mind.
Old Shep, which exactly. I sang many, so many years ago.
I can sit at the piano and play
I know the lyrics.
I'm sure under certain circumstances it could bring somebody to tears. It could be really emotional. I do think Elvis in this early song is a good example of him being able to convey emotion really well. Oh, you know, I forgot to mention, well, it's worth it to mention it now, but I was going to mention when we were talking about Love Me, one of my very favorite parts of the song Love Me is when Elvis gets to the word cruel, that he cracks his voice like very...
Oh, yeah.
And I feel like that's just a studied thing that he really knows how to, he just knows how to convey emotion. It's just this innate ability. And this is a good example. I mean, it's a sad song. You know, if you're in the mood for a song about killing your dog, it could easily bring you to tears.
See, I thought you'd previously mentioned that you liked this song.
Oh,
okay. And that's why I'm like, oh, he likes this one. So I'm not going to get on here and slam it.
No, I mean, it's the kind of song I would feel horrible putting down. I mean, it seems like a really sweet, earnest song from 1935 originally. And, you know, for all I know, it's based on a true story. But no, it's not something I listen to, really. And I do skip it. It is kind of long. God, I remember singing the song to myself because I had to time something that lasted 4 minutes. I can't remember what it was, but I remember singing Old Shep to myself to time 4 minutes before when I was much younger.
Boiling an egg.
Yeah. Nothing negative to say, but yeah, I don't. It's definitely not a favorite. And I do skip it because I do think it's a little too heavy for this album.
Mm.
Maybe.
Well, yeah, I mean, killing your dog, it's not a fun topic to be talking about anyway.
And this used to confuse me when I was little. Well, there's a number of things. First of all, the line, one day the doctor looked at me and said, I can do no more for him, Jim, always drives me crazy because there's no Star Trek person can hear the word Jim and doctor in the same line.
Yes.
And not think, you know, one day the doctor looked at me and said, damn it, Jim, I'm
He's
a doctor.
Dead, Jim.
Yeah, I'm not a veterinarian, I'm a doctor, Jim.
Yep.
So that always sticks in my head. But otherwise, yeah, it's fine.
But if he had changed that Jim to Elvis, it would have been so bizarre.
Oh, my God. Yeah. Yeah, it really, really would have been.
That would have sounded so weird for him to sing his own name.
Yeah, I can't do no more for him, Elvis. Yeah, that would have been very, very weird.
Oh, God. But yeah, I'm sure there's people out there with an emotional attachment to this song because maybe this has happened to them. I mean, everyone's lost a pet.
Yeah. This is like
whatever way.
Right. It's like when we talked about Mama Like the Roses. It's like, you know, it might really hit some people hard, but.
I mean, especially if you heard this song at the right time, at a specific time, like maybe when you were going through that, this song's going to mean 1,000 times more than it does to me. Like, I don't have any attachment to this song.
Well, this
and
one.
The phrase Old Shep means nothing to me, but I hear it generally mentioned in American culture.
Right.
So it's a thing that is out there that means something to some people. But this was the first time I've heard the song.
Right.
And yeah, I don't have any connection to it, but I'm sure some people have a huge connection to this song, but not me.
Yeah. It's probably not worth getting into, but I mean, this goes all the way back to when I was a kid and was first listening to it. And so, okay, he gets a gun to shoot the dog, but then he says he just couldn't do it. He wanted to run.
He couldn't do it. Yeah.
Yeah, I wish they would shoot me instead. And then the dog came and put his head on his knee. And then the next verse is, if dogs have a heaven, that's where he is. So I don't even know. Did he finally shoot the dog? Did he shoot the dog and just wound? What?
I actually did listen to the lyrics to this because I wasn't really paying attention. And then I heard him say something about he had his gun ready. And I'm like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
So then I listened to the lyrics. And it's like, yeah, he was going to put him out of his misery, but then he couldn't do it. And then the dog came to him, put his head on his knee. And then the next line is like, well, the dog's gone now. But there's not explained how or what happened.
Well,
yeah, that is a bit weird. But I suppose if it had any more detail, that's too much, especially if it's kids.
Well, exactly. Especially, there could be a really – I mean, there's one reading where he shoots the dog and just injures it, and it's just – and never mind.
You wouldn't want to hear the outtakes.
No. I got him in the chest and he just came
over.
And then
he just bled out and I watched. It wasn't pretty.
This could be a really different song.
Anyway,
next.
Let's go to the next track. Track 3, Ready Teddy. Again, Robert Blackwell and John Mariscalco.
Yeah.
This is a great track. This is rock and roll. This is the stuff that I like.
Yeah.
And great song. I listened to this song so many times. It's got a great guitar solo. It's got some crazy drum stuff. I noticed it was pretty similar to, what was it? Jailhouse Rock, I think. Just the structure of the song.
Yeah.
The way that it sounds. But yeah, I like this one. This is the rock and roll. This is what I'm here for.
Yeah, I like this a lot too. And just a few days after he records it on like the 3rd, I think, of September. And on September 9th is his first appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. And he does do this song along with some other ones.
So yes.
It's really cool. You can actually watch a really good early live version of him doing Ready Teddy.
Oh, wow. Okay.
But yeah, this is just like you said, it's just classic early rock and roll. It does, have similarities to Jailhouse Rock and Blue Suede Shoes and, all of them, really. They're pretty similar. But in a way that, I say that, but they're all similar in a way that I don't really get sick of and they don't feel repetitious to me.
Mm.
I don't know. That sounds kind of contradictory, but I can see the similarities.
But that's the thing. I mean, so many of these early rock and roll songs, they're all very similar.
They are.
But then they also have their own
identity
somehow, even though they're all quite similar. The structure's the same. The lyrics don't mean much. But there's something about all of them, and you're like, oh, this is this song. Even though it's similar to all the others, they keep their own something.
Identity. Yeah. So yeah, I it's really hard. It's just, it's classic rock and roll. It's the Little Richard version, I think, is pretty similar, but again, it has horns, whereas Elvis strips it down.
Mm.
Yeah, nothing else. I do recommend, it's on YouTube. Check out the Ed Sullivan Show where he's doing it live. It's a lot of, it's more fun.
I will go and watch that one. That's another short one, 155, which is about the same as what Long Tall Sally was. That was, I think, 150, 151 or something. That's Robert Blackwell's favorite length of song. It's about 1:50.
I think the perfect rock and roll song must be like right about 2 minutes.
2 minutes or less, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's go to track 4, Any Place Is Paradise, which to me really sounds like an 80s track. Just the title. There were so many songs about something paradise.
Yeah,
in the
80s. You're right.
Any Place Is Paradise. Joe Thomas, 2:26, drenched with reverb, but somehow I still like this song.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a good little guitar solo, a piano solo. I think the only one on the album. Not a lot of piano solos on this album.
I think So Glad Your Mind had one.
Ah, okay.
I think.
Possibly. But yeah, not a lot of piano solos. One or two on the album. Yeah, this song's fine. I like it. This is a song I don't think I'd ever heard before.
No, I wouldn't.
So again, good to hear just an unheard to me track.
Yeah.
But that's all I got.
Yeah, I have kind of the same thing. I like it. It's a really nice track. It's basically, it's a love song to the person you're with as opposed to like the, unrequited love song or that kind of thing. This is just Any Place Is Paradise as long as I'm with you. Yeah, it's a sweet song. The reverb, I remembered this one having worse reverb than it actually has. I remembered it being much worse. But you can hear Elvis. You can make out all the words. It's not so bad.
His voice, again, I don't think I've even said this once so far this show. Elvis's voice sounds really good on this track. Yeah. I just like the way that he sings it. It is a bit of that vocal style, which people are making fun of, but it's really good on this track. His voice just sounds amazing. I really like it.
Yeah. This whole album, like I said, it really falls between the cracks for me. I just kind of forget about it, I guess, because Love Me Tender is at the same time, kind of, and then that movie overshadows everything. And then we're immediately into Loving You. And the first album was such a big deal. This one just kind of slips through the cracks, and I never revisit it, really. So yeah, a song like Any Place Is Paradise. The last three tracks are all, to me, pretty obscure. I feel like a lot of Elvis people aren't going to know these three songs. That's all I have for Any Place Is Paradise. I like it.
It's fine.
Was it Almost Paradise? I think that was one of the 80s songs.
Oh, there's Almost so many. Paradise.
Yeah, I feel like there was one.
I reckon there must be at least 30 songs in the 80s.
You're probably right.
Something about paradise.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
I can think of a song called Run to Paradise. I can think of A Touch of Paradise.
Paradise City.
Paradise City. It was big. Yeah, the 80s, they loved the paradise.
Yep.
This guy, Joe Thomas, he was ahead of the curve by like 30 years. Good job.
Yeah, they knew.
He beat them all to it. Mm-hmm. So let's go to track 5 on side B, How's the World Treating You? Written by Chet Atkins and Boudelot Bryant.
That's got to be a Louisiana name.
Oh, it looks like it. It's got an X in it.
Yeah, it's got to be.
French.
That sounds Cajun. Yeah.
Now, I only know the name Chet Atkins because he did an album with Tommy Emmanuel called, I think it was The Day the Finger Pickers Took Over the World or something.
Okay.
And Chet Atkins is a CGP, certified guitar player, which I'm not sure who invented. I think he might have invented that himself.
Maybe so.
But there's only 5 CGPs in the world. And after that 5, he said, I'm not naming anyone else as a CGP.
Okay.
And Tommy Emmanuel was one of them, and he's Australian.
Oh, okay.
Guitar player who I've known for a long time. So that's how I know that album, because they did an album together.
Well, he is a legendary guitarist.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's definitely, I think I had heard of him before I knew he had a connection to Elvis.
Mm.
I think of Chet Atkins and like Glenn Campbell and Roy Clark as like these just legendary kind of guitar players. And they all kind of lean country.
Yeah.
Chet Atkins, also known as Mr. Guitar, was an American musician who, along with Owen Bradley and Bob Ferguson, helped create the Nashville sound. Country music style expanded its appeal to pop music, blah, blah, blah. His distinctive picking style musicianship brought him admirers inside and outside of country music. Produced records for Hank Snow, Porter Wagoner, Dolly Parton, Floyd Kramer, Elvis, the Everly Brothers.
Floyd Jerry Kramer, Reed. Didn't he play at one of those Elvis shows?
Oh, yeah. Floyd Kramer is on piano throughout the 60s with Elvis.
Yeah.
But yeah,
there was one show we talked about.
Yes, Floyd Kramer was there.
The guy with the yakety sax. That gig.
Yes, Boots Randolph. That was the one in Hawaii. The one that had Hank Garland, the guitarist, who got in a car accident and couldn't play anymore after that concert. And then Chet Atkins basically took over for him.
Okay.
Yeah, I don't have very much to say. I like it. I guess it's a blues song, basically.
I guess, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't hear the Eddie Arnold version. This is, again, probably one that Elvis... Well, then again, Chet Atkins works for RCA at this point, like developing talent and stuff. So Chet Atkins may have slipped this demo in for Elvis to do. Yeah, I don't really have very much to say about it. I like it. It's a little slow, but I like it.
So let's go to track 6. It's the final song, the last song on side B, How Do You Think I Feel? By Wayne Walker and Webb Pierce, 2:10. I like this song.
Me too.
I didn't think I would. The first maybe 2 times I heard it, I was just thinking, this just sounds like one of those dumb movie songs. It's got that little guitar just being annoying. But then after about 3 or 4 times, I'm like, oh, I actually like it.
Yeah, it's
different. The more I heard it, it was growing on me. Because Elvis is singing his parts, and then this little guitar comes in. And it's like, yeah, okay.
what style would you say this is?
Well, did you say rumba before? It's something. It's not a standard 4/4 rock thing. It's something else.
Yeah, I love whatever's going on. It's got a fun like time signature or beat. Yeah, we were talking about how varied the album is. Yeah, this is such a fun album closer.
I like it. It does seem like, it sort of seems like a weird choice for an album track, but then I'm like, yeah, it sort of works.
Mm-hmm.
But it does just end. The song just ends out of nowhere. It doesn't seem, there's no fade out. It's just like the end.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I'm just remembering.
No, I like it. I like that guitar just echoes the vocals and yeah, fun little song.
It is. I remember having to look up what a gadabout was, because that's an expression that nobody uses anymore.
Ooh, let's bring it back.
But yeah, the girl
What's
I'm mad...
What's a gadabout?
The girl I'm mad about is just a gadabout. Just basically somebody who flits around with lots of different people all over town, doesn't really... can't settle in one place, isn't true to one guy, that kind of thing.
Okay, so she's just all over the place. Okay.
Yeah, another pretty face has put me out of place. Yeah, it's a fun song. It's another fun one to sing along with. It's got a lot of words and a really fun beat. Would have been nice to hear that one. It would have been nice to hear a lot of these live, actually, because other than Long Tall Sally and Love Me.
Yeah. He did sort of lost.
Yeah, he did Ready Teddy on Ed Sullivan, like I said, but the rest of these were never really done live. And I mean, Paralyzed would have been great live.
Yes.
Blue Moon Turns to Gold Again, that's the one that I think he did a little bit of in 1968. But yeah, for the most part, this whole album just kind of, it exists and that's it. It doesn't come back in any other performances. But it is a really good, it's a classic album in general. And yeah, it's a fun song to close because it's such a different, it's just
Do
different.
Do you think, like... Hound Dog and Love Me Tender and the early songs that were big hits, he continued to play those even though it seemed like he didn't particularly want to, but he did it for the fans and he was possibly embarrassed by those early things. Maybe that's why this album was just forgotten. He's like, none of those songs are that great. I don't need to sing them except Love Me.
Well, I think he might have felt the ones on here that really are great, you know, Little Richard already did. I mean, he obviously did love Long Tall Sally and that's the one he came back to. That one and Love Me.
Yeah.
Honestly, I feel like this album might have slipped Elvis's mind almost as much as mine because he just... Like I said, he's in the middle of filming.
There was so much going on in the movie and everything.
He's doing Love Me Tender, and then the next big album is Loving You. I just feel like this just gets lost in the shuffle, even though it was a major album.
And especially if he's not out there singing them live. We're talking literally 3 days of his life.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
It was a weekend. It was a long weekend and never went back to it. So
no. And like I said, he's...
And then there's new movies starting and there's more recordings to do. If he wasn't out doing them live, easy to forget. But it's crazy to think, how does he forget a whole album? But I think there was just so much going on, and most of the tracks weren't that memorable.
No, and the day before...
I can see why it's just, yeah, it just slipped his mind.
Yeah, I said the day before he recorded, he was recording the session, he was doing Love Me Tender songs, and the day right after, he went right back to Love Me Tender. So it's...
So this was right in the middle of, like, recording that soundtrack.
Completely sandwiched. Yeah, completely.
Okay, so that's that track. That's the end. It's the outro. It's the conclusion. There's a couple of songs on here I might come back to, but overall, the reverb just annoyed me.
Yeah.
If anyone out there... I'm going to have a look on YouTube. If someone has somehow de-reverbed some of these tracks... That could improve them, and that'll be the version I'll listen to, even though I know they're not the real thing.
Right.
But it's just so unnecessary, and it's so extreme. It's so extreme, and it's so unnecessary on a couple of these tracks.
Yeah.
That's the thing that really annoys me. Fine, have reverb, but just have a reasonable amount. But they just invented this reverb thing, and everyone just lost their minds, and they're like, let's go crazy.
It does
That's
seem
what
like
it seems it. Like.
It does seem like it's a gimmick at this point in the 50s to just like really put him in it.
Because like you said, the next couple albums after this, it sort of fades away.
It really does.
I mean, there's always reverb, but
yeah,
it
there's
was
always
like at
some.
The peak. This was the peak.
I don't think
peak
I've ever
reverb.
Other than the song on here, First in Line. Yeah, I don't think I've really ever heard anything with quite that much reverb. Like I said, maybe Bebopalula. I keep in my mind that has a bunch of echo, but
yeah,
I agree with you.
Just to have a bit cleaner vocal would be nice.
Would love it. Yeah.
Apart from that, I mean, the songs are okay. There's a couple of good songs. Most of them pretty average. Again, why it could easily slip your mind. Just probably sang them a few times. Well, that's the other thing I read actually is pretty much all these sessions were taped over or something. Like there's like literally one tape of outtakes left, which I think is Rip It Up. The other tapes were just wiped probably because tapes were expensive and we need more tapes.
Yeah, it's so frustrating. You know, there's supposed to be like 50 takes of Hound Dog somewhere, but they're either been taped over or not been found.
Or someone's hoarding them in the basement.
Possibly.
They're probably deteriorated to nothing anyway by now.
Yeah. But yeah, it's a classic album. It did come, you know, in between the major debut album and the first movie soundtrack. So it does get lost in the shuffle. But yeah, I mean, it's classic. I would say, well, all the Little Richard covers, which there are three, all of those are great.
Yeah.
Paralyzed is great. Love Me is great. Blue Moon Turns to Gold Again is great. Yeah, it's a mostly great album now that I think about it. First in Line, the reverb literally ruins it. Old Chap could take or leave it, probably.
And I mean, it's literally a 30-minute album, and the first one was about the same.
Yeah.
I reckon you could just grab both of those two albums, just chuck them in a shuffle
play, yeah.
And you've got an hour of the first two Elvis albums. That'd be good.
Yeah, and then if you go back and add some Sun Records in there, you got even more.
Mm.
But anyway, that's about all I have to say, though.
Yeah, I'm with you. It is, I mean, to me, it was lost and forgotten just because I'd never listened to it. So, but it wasn't because it was lost in all this other stuff. It's just I didn't go back to these early albums.
Yeah.
And now that I've heard it, it's like, yeah, great, I've heard it. I know what was going on then. They were obsessed with reverb. I wonder how many times I've said that word in this whole show. I don't even want to know.
Yeah.
Anyway, so send us a message. Is there too much reverb? Am I just being obsessed over something minor? I don't know.
Yeah.
But it's pretty off-putting at some points. Maybe it's just me. Because you said it's really only one or two tracks, but to me it's like the whole album.
Yeah, no, to me it's mostly First in Line is the one that really is too much.
It's just out of control.
Yeah, other than Heartbreak Hotel, the next few, yeah, I don't know if you're going to find too much. Yeah, this is, to me, that's by far the worst. Yeah, that's the worst.
That's good to know. It's only going up from here.
Right.
Okay, we'll be back in April.
Yeah.
With a new show.
Yes.
We don't know what it'll be. It's a surprise. How exciting.
Yeah. April surprise.
So thank you for listening. It's another episode of Elvis. It's the second album. It was just called Elvis Presley, wasn't it? It didn't have a name.
Well, no, the first album
self-titled?
Was
self-titled?
The first album was Elvis Presley. This was just called Elvis.
This was just Elvis. Okay,
because this
great.
is the one that has the coincidence that Elvis's second album came out October 19th and it was called Elvis. Prince's second album came out October 19th and it was called Prince.
Oh, and they say there's no coincidences. Oh my God.
But yeah, they're both second albums.
That is very interesting. Anyway, thank you for listening. We'll see you next time. And goodbye.
Goodbye, everybody.
Yay!
Elvis has left the building.
Fifty-eight.